I cannot think of anything more stupid. The American public has certainly become aware of all these connections. You can see it in bumper stickers that have come out since 9/11. How many soldiers per gallon does your SUV get? Or, Osama loves your SUV. Or, nothing dumber than a Hummer. Or, draft the SUV drivers first. Or, America needs an oil change. You can see it in the political discourse, as when President Bush, in his 2006 State of the Union address, declared that Americans were addicted to oil. But bumper stickers and slogans aside, the truth is that America has done precious little since 9/11 to end our addiction to oil. We have to do better, because ending our oil addiction is not simply an environmental necessity anymore, it's a strategic imperative. We will only breathe freely, in every sense of that phrase, if we can reduce global demand for oil and gas. Our own oil dependence is behind more bad trends domestically and around the world than any other single factor I can think of. Our addiction to oil makes global warming warmer, petro-dictators stronger, clean air dirtier, poor people poorer, democratic countries weaker, and radical terrorists richer. Have I left anything out? Oil and Islam. Islam has always been practiced in a variety of forms. In the modern era, some are more embracing of modernity, reinterpretation of the Quran, and tolerance of other faiths, like Sufi Islam or the urban-centered populist Islam still found in Cairo, Istanbul, Casablanca, Baghdad, and Damascus. Some strands, like the Salafiyya movement in Islam, followed by the Wahhabi ruling family of Saudi Arabia and by Al-Qaeda, believe Islam should be returned to its purest roots, an austere desert Islam supposedly practiced in the time of the Prophet Muhammad. It is a version of Islam that never fully embraced modernity because its roots were pre-modern and it never aspired to evolve. The term As-Salaf us-Sali, or the Salaf for short, refers to the Prophet Muhammad's immediate companions and the two generations that followed them, who supposedly set the best example for how Islam is to be practiced. Today's followers of this fundamentalist path are called Salafis. Before the 20th century, the fundamentalist Salafi version of Islam had little appeal outside the Arabian desert. Not anymore. Salafi proselytizers, funded by petrodollars from Saudi Arabia, have made a big impact on the way many mainstream Muslims interpret their faith today, as well as how they relate to the faiths of others and to both less orthodox Muslims and non-Sunni Muslims, particularly Shiites. In the hands of Muslim extremists, this oil-funded Salafism has served as the ideological justification for violent jihadism, which aims at restoring the 7th century Islamic caliphate, and it has energized groups such as the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and the Sunni suicide bomb squads of Iraq, Palestine, and Pakistan. The Saudi drive to export Salafi Islam went into high gear after radical fundamentalists challenged the Muslim credentials of the Saudi ruling family by taking over the Grand Mosque of Mecca in 1979, a year that, by coincidence, coincided with the Iranian Revolution and a huge spike in oil prices. As Lawrence Wright notes in his definitive history of Al-Qaeda, The Looming Tower, the attack on the Grand Mosque awakened the royal family to the lively prospect of revolution. The lesson the family drew from that gory standoff was that it could protect itself against religious extremists only by empowering them. Consequently, the Mutawa, government-subsidized religious vigilantes, became an overwhelming presence in the kingdom, roaming through the shopping malls and restaurants, chasing men into mosques at prayer time, and ensuring that women were properly cloaked. Not content to cleanse its own country of the least degree of religious freedom, the Saudi government set out to evangelize the Islamic world, using the billions of rials at its disposal through the religious tax, zakat, to construct hundreds of mosques and colleges and thousands of religious schools around the globe, staffed with Wahhabi imams and teachers. Eventually, Saudi Arabia, which constitutes only 1% of the world Muslim population, would support 90% of the expenses of the entire faith, overriding other traditions of Islam. Music disappeared in the kingdom. Censorship smothered art and literature, and intellectual life, which had scarcely had the chance to blossom in the young country, withered. Paranoia and fanaticism naturally occupy minds that are closed and fearful. There are roughly 1.5 billion Muslims in the world, living in every major city. Because Saudi Arabia has enormous oil resources and is the keeper of Islam's two holiest mosques in Mecca and Medina, it has both a unique legitimacy in the Muslim world and a unique level of resources to advance its ultra-conservative brand of Islam around the Muslim world. Never has so much wealth been given to such an extreme minority of one of the world's biggest religions, with so many long-term consequences. 50 years from now, when we look back at this onset of the energy climate era, we may conclude that the most important geopolitical trend to come out of it was this shift in the center of gravity of Islam, away from a Cairo, Istanbul, Casablanca, Damascus, urban Mediterranean center of gravity in the 19th and 20th centuries, which tended to be softer-edged, more open to the world and other faiths, and toward a Salafi, Saudi, desert-centered Islam, which was much more puritanical, restrictive toward women, and hostile to other faiths. The rise of this more fundamentalist strain of Islam in the past two decades is by no means entirely attributable to Saudi money. A broader backlash against globalization and westernization is also at work in the Muslim world, as well as a rejection of all the previous failed ideologies, Arab nationalism, Arab socialism, and communism, by a new generation of Muslim youth. But Saudi money has certainly helped to fuel and consolidate this upsurge in rigidly orthodox Islam, which comes at a time when, as the Financial Times reported June 4, 2008, nearly two-thirds of the Middle East's population is under the age of 25, and more than one in four are unemployed. Many of these frustrated, unemployed youth are finding succor in faith. The writer William G. Ridgway, who penned a thoughtful and provocative series of Letters from Arabia for the iconoclastic British research institute, the Social Affairs Unit, argued in an essay, August 22, 2005, that this shift is in some ways a modern version of a long-running struggle between a puritanical desert Islam represented by sects like the Saudi Wahhabis and a much more cosmopolitan, woman-friendly, and open to ideas, urban Islam. Encroaching modernity has resulted in an increase in the place and power of desert Islam in everyday society, wrote Ridgway. Contrary to widespread Western beliefs about the trajectory of the Middle East as a hesitant but inevitable climb to liberal democracy, the region is actually going the other way, fast. Academics call this Islamicization, the spread of radical Shia and Wahhabi beliefs and practices throughout the region. Because of this trend, the Middle East one sees nowadays is nothing like it was, say, 50 years ago. Around the 1950s, about the time oil was being discovered in the Gulf, many Muslim nations were relatively liberal by today's standards. Alcohol flowed freely, women went uncovered, and there was lively public debate about Ataturk's way, the separation of Islam and state, modernization, and dialogue with the West. The Middle East seemed to be going in the right direction. The explosion of oil wealth in Saudi Arabia served to change all that. Oil meant that the Saudis now had the means to change the world to more resemble them, said Ridgway. The mountain would come to Mohammed. In true puritanical style, desert Islam has taken the spice and color out of Arab life, and it looks like it will be doing so for a long time yet. The joys of flirtation or provocative self-expression through dress or lack of it are gone, all replaced by black. Ridgway argues that the now oil-funded Saudi Wahhabi version of Islam represents an attack on liberal urban Islam by a desert sect that was peripheral in the golden age of Arab culture or, indeed, filmmaking. Perhaps the best symbol of all that has been lost is the coquettish, slightly tipsy Arab woman so beloved of old Arab comedies. Then she was laughed at. Now she would be stoned to death. In addition to Saudi Arabia, other conservative Gulf states, Kuwait, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates, have also enjoyed a massive influx of oil funds, which have also found their way to more conservative charities and religious institutions at home and abroad. Here is what a professor friend of mine, an Egyptian who teaches in a Persian Gulf state, told me over breakfast in the Gulf in August 2007. For personal security reasons, he could not let his name be used. Saudi Arabia, he said, has had a huge impact on Islamic life all across the Muslim world. Look at the relations between men and women. Men and women in the same family used to sit with each other in the same room. Now they are separate. Today, in the Persian Gulf, the relationship between the two sexes is sensitive. You don't know if you should shake a woman's hand or not. This Saudi Islamization of the region has left a very bad impact, and it will take decades to fix it. If you go to university in a Persian Gulf state, there is no mixing in education. When I was a student in Egypt, I used to sit next to a girl in class. Now, both sexes exist in the same classroom, but they tend to divide on their own. This is not Egyptian Islam. It is the Saudi way. The worst thing is that the Saudis had the money, but Egypt was the body that practiced their ideas. We imported the Saudi way of life into Egypt, the dress, the books sold at the doors of mosques. These carry the same Wahhabi interpretation of Islam. Unfortunately, Egypt did not have the resources to fight back. And it still doesn't. A story from Cairo by Newsweek's Middle East correspondent, Rod Nordland, June 9, 2008, made this clear. Abir Sabri, celebrated for her alabaster skin, ebony hair, pouting lips, and full figure, used to star in racy Egyptian TV shows and movies. Then, at the peak of her career a few years ago, she disappeared. At least, her face did. She began performing on Saudi-owned religious TV channels, with her face covered, chanting verses from the Quran. Conservative Saudi Arabian financiers promised her plenty of work, she says, as long as she cleaned up her act. It's the Wahhabi investors, she says, referring to the strict form of Sunni Islam prevalent in Saudi Arabia. Before, they invested in terrorism, and now they put their money in culture and the arts. Egyptians deplore what they call the Saudization of their culture. Egypt has long dominated the performing arts from Morocco to Iraq, but now petrodollar-flush Saudi investors are buying up the contracts of singers and actors, reshaping the TV and film industries, and setting a media agenda rooted more in strict Saudi values than in those of freewheeling Egypt. As far as I'm concerned, this is the biggest problem in the Middle East right now, says mobile phone billionaire Naqib Sawiris. Egypt was always very liberal, very secular, and very modern. Now, he gestures from the window of his 26th floor Cairo office, I'm looking at my country, and it's not my country any longer. I feel like an alien here. At the Grand Hyatt Cairo, a mile upstream along the Nile, the five-star hotel's Saudi owner banned alcohol as of May 1, 2008, and ostentatiously ordered its $1.4 million inventory of booze flushed down the drains. A hotel in Egypt without alcohol is like a beach without a sea, says Ali Murad, chairman of Studio Masr, the country's oldest film outfit. He says Saudis, who don't even have movie theaters in their own country, now finance 95% of the films made in Egypt. They say, here, you can have our money, but there are just a few little conditions. More than a few, actually. The 35 rules, as movie makers call them, go far beyond predictable bans against on-screen hugging, kissing, or drinking. Even to show an empty bed is forbidden, lest it hint that someone might do something on it. Saudi-owned satellite channels are buying up Egyptian film libraries, heavily censoring some old movies while keeping others off the air entirely. Some Egyptians say the new prudishness isn't entirely the Saudis' fault. Films are becoming more conservative because the whole society is becoming more conservative, says filmmaker Marianne Khoury, who says Saudi cash has been a lifeline to the 80-year-old industry. From a peak of more than 100 films yearly in the 1960s and 70s, Egyptian studios' output plunged to only a half dozen a year in the 90s. Thanks to Saudi investors, it's now about 40. If they stopped, there would be no Egyptian films, says Khoury. At least a few Egyptians say Saudi Arabia is the country that's ultimately going to change. Egypt will be back to what it used to be, predicts the single named Dina, one of Egypt's few remaining native-born belly dancers. And it was a Saudi production company that financed a 2006 drama that frankly discusses homosexuality, The Yacoubian Building. Sawiris has launched a popular satellite TV channel of his own, showing uncensored American movies. He's determined to win. But he's only one billionaire, and Saudi Arabia is swarming with them. An America addicted to oil has never figured out how to deal with this phenomenon. During the Cold War, notes the former CIA director Jim Woolsey, Americans got used to dealing with Soviet totalitarians whose secular, economic-based ideology, inspired by a long-dead 19th-century thinker, could be contained. There weren't too many Marxists, said Woolsey, who really wanted to commit suicide for the idea, from each according to his ability and to each according to his needs. The ideology that our energy purchases are indirectly fueling today is much more malevolent and openly embracing of suicide. Wahhabi teachings, as articulated in the fatwas of their imams, are extremely hostile with respect to Shiites, Jews, homosexuals, and apostates, and horribly repressive with respect to everyone else, especially women, notes Woolsey. They are essentially the same basic beliefs as those expressed by Al-Qaeda. In other words, in purely ideological terms, there is very little difference between the reigning religious tenets in Saudi Arabia, a key U.S. ally, and those of Al-Qaeda, a key U.S. enemy. It's their means that differ. Indeed, said Woolsey, the fundamental argument between the Wahhabis and Al-Qaeda is not about underlying beliefs. It is rather a struggle, a bit like that between the Stalinists and Trotskyites of the 20s and 30s, over which of them should be in charge. The hate-filled underlying views of both, however, point in the same overall direction. Many Wahhabi-funded madrasas worldwide echo and perpetrate this hatred and thus promote its consequences. No one has chronicled the impact that Saudi oil money has had in the Muslim communities beyond the Middle East better than Greg Mortensen and David Oliver Rellen in their classic book, Three Cups of Tea, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace, One School at a Time. The book details how this American mountain climber turned educator built the Central Asia Institute and constructed more than 50 progressive schools across rural Pakistan and Afghanistan to fight Islamic extremism by trying to alleviate poverty and improve access to education, especially for girls. The number of schools is now up to 78 and counting. I'd known that the Saudi Wahhabi sect was building mosques along the Afghan border for years, Mortensen says in the book. I was amazed by all their new construction right here in the heart of Shiite Baltistan, Pakistan. For the first time, I understood the scale of what they were trying to do, and it scared me. In December 2000, the Saudi publication Ain al-Yaqeen reported that one of the four major Wahhabi proselytizing organizations, the Al-Haramain Foundation, had built 1,100 mosques, schools, and Islamic centers in Pakistan and other Muslim countries, and employed 3,000 paid proselytizers in the previous year. The most active of the four groups, Ain al-Yaqeen reported, the International Islamic Relief Organization, which the 9/11 Commission would later accuse of directly supporting the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, completed the construction of 3,800 mosques, spent $45 million on Islamic education, and employed 6,000 teachers, many of them in Pakistan, throughout the same period. Mortensen said the resources he had to build his little network of progressive schools across Pakistan and along the Afghan border were peanuts compared to the Wahhabi. Every time I visited to check on one of our projects, it seemed 10 Wahhabi madrasas had popped up nearby overnight. Pakistan's dysfunctional educational system made advancing Wahhabi doctrine a simple matter of economics. A tiny percentage of the country's wealthy children attended elite private schools, but vast swaths of the country were barely served by Pakistan's struggling, inadequately funded public schools. The madrasa system targeted the impoverished students the public system failed. By offering free room and board and building schools in areas where none existed, madrasas provided millions of Pakistan's parents with their only opportunity to educate their children. I don't want to give the impression that all Wahhabi are bad, Mortensen says. Many of their schools and mosques are doing good work to help Pakistan's poor. But some of them seem to exist only to teach militant jihad. Mortensen was very clear-eyed about the extent that this phenomenon was being subsidized by our energy purchases. This wasn't just a few Arab sheikhs getting off Gulf Air flights with bags of cash. They were bringing the brightest madrasa students back to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait for a decade of indoctrination, then encouraging them to take four wives when they came home and breed like rabbits. They're churning out generation after generation of brainwashed students and thinking 20, 40, even 60 years ahead to a time when their armies of extremism will have the numbers to swarm over Pakistan and the rest of the Islamic world. If desert Islam overwhelms urban Islam, thanks in part to our energy purchases, it will have a profound impact on the geopolitics of the energy climate era. According to the Egyptian scholar Mamoun Fandi, the author of Uncivil War of Words, Media and Politics in the Arab World, and senior fellow for Gulf Security in the Middle East program at the International Institute of Strategic Studies in London, it will push Islam toward the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf. I like to say that there is the Islam of the Mediterranean and the Islam of the Red Sea. As Islam's center of gravity moves toward the Mediterranean, which is a universe of shipping and trade and interaction, the world of Beirut, Istanbul, Alexandria, or Andalusia, the religion and its community becomes more cosmopolitan, outward-looking, and engaging. As Islam moves toward the Red Sea, close to the harsh, isolated desert and the sources of crude oil, it becomes more frightened, inward-looking, and xenophobic. Lately, There is good news and bad news from Saudi Arabia. The good news is that the ruling Al Saud family has begun taking real steps to try to rein in their most virulent jihadist preachers, religious scholars, and youth, and to crack down on Saudis who either join domestic terrorist organizations or volunteer for suicide missions abroad. The bad news is that the Salafist Wahhabi ideology is so deeply embedded in the Saudi religious education system that trying to dial it down is no easy task. The Saudi ruling family never worried that much about the violent jihadists as long as their militancy was directed abroad. But in recent years, as the jihadists have launched attacks against Saudi institutions at home, the regime has taken the threat much more seriously. On March 20, 2008, the BBC quoted the Saudi-owned newspaper Ashark Al-Asad as saying that the kingdom is to retrain its 40,000 prayer leaders, also known as imams, in an effort to counter militant Islam. That is the equivalent of a remedial course for the country's entire top clerical leadership. It also gives you some idea how deep the problem had become when you read that these same Saudi prayer leaders have been expressly called upon to stop cursing Christians and Jews. In the government-directed newspaper Al-Riyad, February 1, 2008, the columnist Dr. Saad Al-Kuwaiti wrote, "The call to destroy all Christians and all Jews contravenes divine law." He added that curses should not be directed at the infidels as a collective, but only at those who hurt the Muslims and fight them. Are petrodollars fueling more positive trends? One does have to note that this massive influx of wealth is also stimulating some powerful forces of modernization in every oil-rich state. More women are getting educated, and not only in religious schools. Many more men and women are able to study abroad. New universities are being opened. More media are being started in the Arab-Muslim world, including some new, reasonably independent and progressive television channels and newspapers. Arab Gulf states are rapidly globalizing, hosting international conferences and inviting American and European universities to open branches in their countries. Have these American academic seedlings taken root? Not yet, but the whole trend needs to be watched, particularly in Saudi Arabia. Having reported from Saudi Arabia, I can say without hesitation that there are moderate and even emphatically pro-Western Saudis who have studied in America, visit regularly, and still root for their favorite American football teams. I've met with them. I've argued with them. I enjoy their company. They deeply love their faith and are embarrassed by the excesses of Salafi Wahhabi extremists, who have given Saudi Arabia a black eye in the world, most grotesquely in 2002, when 15 Saudi schoolgirls died after the Mutawa would not let them out of their burning school building or allow firemen in because the girls' faces and bodies weren't covered according to Saudi tradition. I am ready to believe that many Saudis would prefer to see a more open Islamic nation, but they are not the ones setting religious policy, and it is not their progressive outlook that is being exported to the madrasas of Pakistan, London, Mosul, and Jakarta. More is at stake here than how many women have to wear veils. In Iraq, young Sunni Muslims from Saudi Arabia, North Africa, and across the Arab world, who were inspired by Saudi Wahhabi imams or their ideology, have become the heart of the suicide bombing corps that has done more to hold the U.S.-led forces to a stalemate in the war in Iraq and to poison relations between Sunnis and Shiites there than any other factor. If I could somehow snap my fingers and cut off the funding from one country, it would be Saudi Arabia, Stuart Levy, the Bush administration's Undersecretary of the Treasury, told ABC News September 12, 2007. 2 months later, November 22, 2007, The New York Times reported that data taken from a cache of documents and computers found during a raid on a tent camp in the desert near Sinjar, Iraq, near the Syrian border, had revealed that Saudi Arabia and Libya, both considered allies by the United States in its fight against terrorism, were the source of about 60% of the foreign fighters who came to Iraq in the past year to serve as suicide bombers or to facilitate other attacks. The raid's target was an insurgent cell believed to be responsible for smuggling the vast majority of foreign fighters into Iraq. Saudis accounted for the largest number of fighters listed on the records by far, 305, or 41%, American intelligence officers found as they combed through documents and computers in the weeks after the raid. The data show that despite increased efforts by Saudi Arabia to clamp down on would-be terrorists since September 11, 2001, some Saudi fighters are still getting through. The article quoted senior American military officials as saying that they also believe that Saudi citizens provided the majority of financing for Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia in order to prevent Shiites from dominating the Baghdad government. The article noted that the Sinjar documents indicate that each foreigner brought about $1,000 with him, used mostly to finance operations of the smuggling cell. Saudis brought more money per person than fighters from other nations, the American officials said. On a visit I made to Kurdistan in August 2007, a senior Kurdish security official remarked to me, "The Saudis are exporting their terrorists. It works two ways for them. One, they get rid of their terrorists, and two, in Iraq, the terrorists are killing people the Saudis hate, like Shiites. All that the Sunni Al-Qaeda types in Iraq have to do," he added, "is make one trip to Qatar or the UAE or Saudi Arabia, and they come back with bags of money." Petropolitics helps to lubricate this whole process. The Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, a Washington-based think tank that tracks the impact of oil on geopolitics, explained how, in a paper entitled "Fueling Terror," authored by IAGS's co-directors Gal Luft and Ann Corin. Take Saudi Arabia, for example. Many of its charities are truly dedicated to good causes, but others merely serve as money laundering and terrorist financing apparatuses. While many Saudis contribute to those charities in good faith, believing their money goes toward good causes, others know full well the terrorist purposes to which their money will be funneled. What makes penetration and control of money transactions in the Arab world especially difficult is the hawala system, the unofficial method of transferring money and one of the key elements in the financing of global terrorism. The system has been going for generations and is deeply embedded in the Arab culture. Hawala transactions are based on trust. They are carried out verbally, leaving no paper trail. The Saudi regime has been complicit in its people's actions and has turned a blind eye to the phenomenon of wealthy citizens sending money to charities that in turn route it to terror organizations. If not for the West's oil money, most Gulf states would not have had the wealth that allowed them to invest so much in arms procurement and sponsor terrorist organizations, argued the IAGS, noting that Saudi Arabia's oil revenues make up 90 to 95% of total Saudi export earnings and 70 to 80% of state revenues. Most wealthy Saudis who sponsor charities and educational foundations that preach religious intolerance and hate toward the Western values have made their money from the petroleum industry or its subsidiaries. Osama bin Laden's wealth comes from the family's construction company that made its fortune from government contracts financed by oil money. While Saudi Arabia provides the financial fuel for the global spread of Salafi fundamentalist Islam, Iran, since the toppling of the Shah in 1979, has done the same for its brand of revolutionary Shiite Islam. Indeed, the two states see themselves as rivals for the role of authentic leader and model state for the Muslim world. In other words, the year 1979 gave birth to the first modern global religious arms race between an oil-rich Saudi Salafi state — Saudi Arabia is OPEC's largest oil producer — and an oil-rich Shiite Revolutionary Islamic Republic — Iran is OPEC's second-largest oil producer — over who would most influence the direction of the Muslim world. Immediately after Hezbollah launched a reckless war against Israel from Lebanon in the summer of 2006, Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah, declared that Hezbollah would begin paying out cash to the thousands of Lebanese families whose homes were destroyed by Israeli retaliations. "We will pay compensation, a certain amount of money, for every family to rent for 1 year, plus buy furniture for those whose homes were totally destroyed," said Nasrallah. These number 15,000. Nasrallah also vowed that his organization would help rebuild damaged houses and businesses, promising those affected that they will not need to ask anyone for money or wait in queues to get relief funds. To paraphrase the Allstate commercial, "You're in good hands with Hezbollah." But wait, where would Hezbollah get the $3 billion plus needed to rebuild Lebanon? The organization doesn't manufacture anything. It doesn't tax its followers. The answer, of course, is that Iran would dip into its oil income and ship cash to Nasrallah so that he would not have to face the wrath of the Lebanese for starting a war that reaped nothing but destruction. Yes, thanks to then $70 a barrel oil, Hezbollah could have Katyusha rockets and butter at the same time. When oil money is so prevalent, why not? Hezbollah and Iran were like a couple of rich college students who rented Lebanon for the summer, as if it were a beach house. "Come on, let's smash up the place," they said to themselves. "Who cares? Dad will pay." The only thing Nasrallah didn't say to the Lebanese was, "Hey, keep the change." For all these reasons, President Bush's refusal to do anything significant after 9/11 to reduce our gasoline consumption really amounted to a policy of no mullah left behind. The former CIA director, Jim Woolsey, put it more bluntly: "We are funding the rope for the hanging of ourselves." Oil and freedom. This massive transfer of wealth for oil is tilting not just the Muslim world, but also global politics at large. Wherever governments can raise most of their revenues by simply drilling a hole in the ground rather than tapping their people's energy, creativity, and entrepreneurship, freedom tends to be curtailed, education underfunded, and human development retarded. That is because of what I call the first law of petropolitics. I started mulling the first law of petropolitics after 9/11, reading the daily headlines and listening to the news. When I heard Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, telling British Prime Minister Tony Blair to go to hell and telling his supporters that the U.S.-sponsored free trade area of the Americas coalition can go to hell too, I couldn't help saying to myself, I wonder if the president of Venezuela would be saying all these things if the price of oil today were $20 a barrel rather than $60 or $70 a barrel, and his country had to make a living by empowering its own entrepreneurs, not just drilling holes in the ground. As I followed events in the Persian Gulf during the past few years, I also noticed that the first Gulf state to hold a free and fair parliamentary election in which women could run and vote was Bahrain, the tiny island state off the east coast of Saudi Arabia. Bahrain was also the first Gulf state to hire McKinsey & Company to design an overhaul of its labor laws to make its people more productive, more employable, and less dependent on imported labor, and the first Gulf state to sign a free trade agreement with the United States. Bahrain's king and his advisors minced no words about the objectives. To break the culture of dependency on the oil welfare state that had dominated their economy since independence in 1971, to link wage increases to increases in productivity, and to put an end to the practice of starting a manufacturing business by importing 500 low-wage workers from India or Bangladesh, which meant that a Bahraini factory was supporting the owner's family very well, along with the families of 500 workers from South Asia, but not supporting any Bahraini workers or their families. Bahrain, which is a constitutional monarchy with a king and an elected parliament, also overhauled its education system, creating a program to retrain all its teachers and establishing a new system of polytechnics to impart vocational skills to young Bahrainis who might not want to go to college. Bahrain also opened itself more than ever to foreign direct investment from abroad and privatization of state-supported industries at home in order to stimulate real competition between firms within Bahrain, and to differentiate its economy from the forms of economic competition elsewhere in the Gulf, which usually consists of two government-financed companies supposedly competing with each other. Now, why was all this happening in Bahrain in the middle of the 2007 oil boom? Because Bahrain was not only the first Persian Gulf country to discover oil in 1932, it was, more important, the first Gulf oil state to start running out of oil around 1998. Not surprisingly, Bahrain's first public debate about corruption was in 1998, when crude oil prices fell to below $15 a barrel. Unlike all its oil-rich neighbors, Bahrain in the 1990s could practically mark the day on the calendar when it would have no more oil revenue to rely upon, so it had no choice but to nurture and exploit the talents of its people instead. I couldn't help asking myself, could that just be a coincidence? The first Gulf state that runs out of oil is also the first to explore all these political and economic reforms? I don't think it was a coincidence at all. Also, when I looked across the Arab world and saw a popular democracy movement in Lebanon evicting Syria's occupying army, I couldn't help saying to myself, is it an accident that the Arab world's first and only real democracy, Lebanon, also happens to be one of the few Arab states that never had a drop of oil? The more I pondered these questions, the more it seemed obvious to me that there must be a correlation, a literal correlation that could be measured and graphed between the price of oil and the pace, scope, and sustainability of political freedoms and economic reforms in certain countries. One afternoon over lunch with Moises Naim, the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, I laid out my napkin and drew a graph showing how there seemed to be a rough correlation between the price of oil between 1975 and 2005 and the pace of freedom in oil-producing states during those same years. When one went down, the other went up. Think about it, I told Moises. In 2001, when oil was $25 to $30 a barrel, George W. Bush looked into Russian President Vladimir Putin's soul and saw a friend of America there. I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. I was able to get a sense of his soul. But you look into Putin's soul today, with oil topping $100 a barrel, and you'll see the Gazprom and Lukos oil companies, the Izvestia and Pravda newspapers, the parliament, and every other democratic institution in Russia that Putin has swallowed courtesy of $100 a barrel oil. Or as one world leader, who asked not to be named, remarked to me during an interview, when oil was $20 a barrel, Putin had 20% of the Russian vote. When it was $100 a barrel, he had 100% of the Russian vote. When oil dipped below $20 a barrel in 1997, Iran elected the reformer Mohammad Khatami as president, and he called for a dialogue of civilizations. In 2005, with oil selling around $60 to $70 a barrel, Iran elected Mohammad Ahmadinejad, who said the Holocaust is a myth. I guarantee you, I told Moises, at $20 a barrel, the Holocaust won't be a myth anymore. Moises took the napkin, went back to his office, and showed it to his staff. An hour later, he called me and asked that I turn my napkin into an article for Foreign Policy, which I did, May to June 2006. On one axis, I plotted the average global price of crude oil going back to 1979, and along the other axis, I plotted the pace of expanding or contracting freedoms, both economic and political, as measured by the Freedom House Freedom in the World Report and the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom of the World Report for Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and Nigeria. This included free and fair elections held, newspapers opened or closed, arbitrary arrests made, reformers elected to parliaments, economic reform projects started or stopped, companies privatized and companies nationalized, and so on. I would be the first to point out that this is not a scientific lab experiment, because the rise and fall of economic and political freedom in a society can never be perfectly quantifiable or interchangeable. While the correlations were rough, they were also unmistakable enough for me to offer the first law of petropolitics, which posits the following. In oil-rich petrolist states, the price of oil and the pace of freedom tend to move in opposite directions. That is, the higher the average global crude oil price rises, the more that free speech, free press, free and fair elections, freedom of assembly, government transparency, judicial independence, rule of law, and the formation of independent political parties and non-governmental organizations are eroded. All these negative trends are also reinforced by the fact that the higher the price goes, the less petrolist leaders care about what the world thinks or says about them. They have more disposable income to build up domestic security forces, bribe opponents, buy votes or public support, and resist international norms. Conversely, according to the first law of petropolitics, the lower the price of oil goes, the swifter the pace of freedom. Petrolist countries are forced to move toward a politics and a society that is more transparent, more sensitive to opposition voices, more open to a broad set of interactions with the outside world, and more focused on building the legal and educational structures that will maximize the ability of their citizens, men and women, to compete, start new companies, and attract investments from abroad. And, naturally, the lower the price of crude oil falls, the more petrolist leaders are sensitive to what outsiders think of them. I define petrolist states as authoritarian states, or ones with weak state institutions, that are highly dependent on oil production for the bulk of their exports and government income. In virtually every case, these states accumulated their oil wealth before they established sound and transparent institutions of governance. High on my list of petrolist states would be Angola, Gabon, Nigeria, Iran, Russia, Egypt, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, Uzbekistan, Azerbaijan, Indonesia, Venezuela, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, Syria, Equatorial Guinea, Sudan, Burma, and Saudi Arabia. Countries that have a lot of crude oil but were well-established states with solid democratic institutions and diversified economies before their oil was discovered, Norway, the United States, Denmark, Great Britain, are not subject to the first law of petropolitics. As oil prices went down in the early 1990s, competition, transparency, political participation, and accountability of those in office all tended to go up in these countries, as measured by free elections held, newspapers opened, reformers elected, economic reform projects started, and companies privatized. But as oil prices started to soar after 2000, free speech, free press, fair elections, and freedom to form political parties and NGOs tended to erode in these countries. In a country like Bahrain, where the leadership used the fact that it was gradually running out of oil as a burning platform to drive its reform agenda, the steep run-up in oil prices since 2006 has actually been something of a problem. It forced the Bahraini reformers to reframe their argument. Sheikh Mohammed bin Essa Al Khalifa, the CEO of the state-appointed Bahrain Economic Development Board, told me, "We had to change our argument about why we needed to reform from a need to an aspiration. It was a much harder sell. $100 a barrel oil has not stopped Bahrain's reform process," said Al Khalifa, "but it slows you down. The parliament is just a little slower in approving laws that require more open competition and less government intervention." To be sure, professional economists have long pointed out that an abundance of natural resources can be bad for a country's economy and politics. This phenomenon has been variously diagnosed as Dutch disease or the resource curse. Dutch disease refers to the process of deindustrialization that can come about as a result of a natural resource windfall. The term was coined in the Netherlands in the early 1960s, after the Dutch discovered huge deposits of natural gas in the North Sea. What happens in a country with Dutch disease is this. First, the value of the currency rises, thanks to the sudden influx of cash from oil, gold, gas, diamonds, or some other natural resource discovery. The strong currency, in effect, raises the price of the nation's goods to foreign buyers, making the country's manufactured exports very non-competitive and imports very cheap for its citizens. The citizens, flush with cash, start buying cheaper imported goods without restraint. The domestic manufacturing sector gets wiped out, and presto, you have deindustrialization. The resource curse can refer to the same economic phenomenon as well as to the way a dependence on natural resources can skew a country's political, investment, and education priorities, so that everything revolves around who controls those resources and who gets how much money from them. Very often in petrolist states, the public develops a distorted notion of what development is all about. The people conclude that their country is poor and the leaders or some other group are rich, not because the country has failed to promote education, innovation, rule of law, and entrepreneurship, but only because someone is stealing the oil money and depriving them of their due. Often, they are right. Someone is stealing. But people start to think that in order to become prosperous, all they have to do is stop those who are stealing, not build a society brick by brick on the foundations of better education, rule of law, innovation, and entrepreneurship. If Nigeria had no oil, then the entire political equation would be different. Clement and Nwankwo, one of Nigeria's leading human rights campaigners, told me during a visit to Washington in March 2006. The income would not be coming from oil, and therefore the diversification of the economy would become an issue, and private enterprise would matter more, and people would have to expand their own creativity. And Nwankwo's remarks reminded me what a westernized Iranian woman reporter in Tehran once said to me as we were walking down the street. If only we didn't have oil, we could be just like Japan. The first law of petropolitics tries to build on such arguments, but also takes the correlation between oil and politics one step further, proposing that not only does the presence of excessive oil revenues in petrolist states tend to have broad negative effects on democratization, but so does the actual price. The actual price of oil and the actual pace of, or retreat from, democratization are roughly correlated. One of the most incisive analyses that I have come across as to why this correlation exists was a study, Does Oil Hinder Democracy? By the UCLA political scientist Michael L. Ross, World Politics, April 2001, in which he provides a detailed explanation of how and why massive oil exports and democracy usually do not mix. Using a statistical analysis from 113 states between 1971 and 1997, Ross concluded that a state's reliance on either oil or mineral exports tends to make it less democratic, that this effect is not caused by other types of primary exports, that it is not limited to the Arabian Peninsula, to the Middle East, or to sub-Saharan Africa, and it is not limited to small states. What I find particularly useful about Ross's work is his list of the precise mechanisms by which excessive oil wealth impedes the growth of democracy. First, he argues, there is the taxation effect. Oil-rich governments tend to use their revenues to relieve social pressures that might otherwise lead to demands for greater accountability from and representation in their government. The way I like to put it is, the motto of the American Revolution was no taxation without representation. The motto of the petrolist authoritarian state is no taxation, so no representation either. Oil-backed regimes that do not have to tax their people for revenue because they can just drill an oil well and sell the oil abroad also do not have to listen to their people or represent their wishes. The second mechanism through which oil dampens democratization, argues Ross, is the spending effect. Oil wealth leads to greater patronage spending, which in turn dampens pressures for democratization. The third mechanism he cites is the group formation effect. When oil revenues provide an already non-democratic or weak state with a cash windfall, the government will use its largesse to prevent the formation of social groups that are independent from the state, Ross writes. In addition, he argues, an overabundance of oil revenues can create a repression effect because it allows governments to spend excessively on police, internal security, and intelligence forces that can be used to choke democratic movements. Finally, he argues, there might also be an anti-modernization effect at work. This refers to the fact that massive oil wealth in a society tends to diminish pressures for occupational specialization, urbanization, and the securing of higher levels of education, trends that normally accompany broad-based economic development and also produce a public that is more articulate, free to organize, and endowed with multiple autonomous economic power centers of its own. In a later study, based on data from 169 countries, Ross demonstrated why women in Middle Eastern countries continue to be undereducated, underrepresented in the workforce, and politically disempowered. Oil. In the Middle East, Ross wrote in his essay, Oil, Islam, and Women, American Political Science Review, February 2008. Fewer women work outside the home, and fewer hold positions in government than in any other region of the world. According to most observers, this